Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech language pathologist, and we are waiting on Kate Hensler, DI extraordinaire, to join us. I've spoken with her. She's planning to call in, but so far she's not on the switchboard yet. So I'm hoping that happens in the next few seconds so that I don't have heart failure here. Today is Sunday, December 19th, and if you've joined us now, you're listening live, and I'm so excited to have you here. We would absolutely love a caller tonight, and our call-in number is, here's Kate. I'm going to put her on. Hey.
Hi there.
Gave me a little heart failure there.
Sorry.
That's okay. All right, I'm giving the...
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
No, it wasn't important. Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say I'm giving the call-in number. It's 1-718-766-4332, and we would absolutely love a caller tonight, wouldn't we?
We would love a caller. Please call in. Don't be shy. It's just like talking on the phone. We all do that pretty well, I think.
I think so, too. Yeah, no nerves around here. This is, we're pretty low-key, pretty,
casual.
Casual, that was good. I was going to say non-professional, but that was not the word I was looking for.
Hey, speak for yourself. Casual,
oh,
that's what we are.
Casual, that would be very informal is what I usually say in conferences. I couldn't figure out what word to say. Okay, we have two topics for tonight, and let's get going since we've talked ourselves almost into a hole again. Well, first of all, before we do that, let me remind listeners of the things that I'm supposed to say before we start. First of all, I'm going to keep plugging away at that Kentucky conference in Louisville, our hometown, on January 21st, and it's especially designed for First Steps providers in the state of Kentucky and will meet all of your contractual requirements for atypical and typically developing continuing education requirements that we have to have, and I'm getting great response from all over the state. So I thought, gosh, I'm going to go ahead and plug it again. I know nearly as many people from outside of Louisville have signed up as Louisville people, so I'm so excited about that. So that's great. And then secondly, I'm still running the 20% off any DVD purchase on my website at teachmetotalk.com, and just enter the code HAPPY and the number 3 since it's coming up on my third year anniversary for the website. And so that's probably going to run one more week. So I wanted to plug that. And then I have a really kind of quirky request. If there's any speech pathologist that's from Florida and works in the state early intervention system, and you can answer some questions for me because I'm trying to schedule a Florida conference, but I don't want to do it until I've had a couple more questions answered, please email me at laura@teachmetotalk.com because I have some really picky things to ask, and I can't find out a way to get those questions asked other than talking to a real-life person, and that's hard to do over the weekend, and especially will be hard to do over spring break or Christmas break. So I thought maybe sending out a help for or a request for help on the podcast would be good. Boy, am I stumbling all over my words tonight, Kate. You're just going to have to be in charge and run the whole thing tonight.
Friend, you've gone from New Orleans and Baton Rouge down to Florida. What is there a plan there, Laura? You're going further and further south with each conference.
I'm going for the warm. I'm going for warmth because we're living in the Arctic tundra in Kentucky this winter. Haven't we had a brutal winter so far?
So far, it's been worse than a number of them, I know. It's a weird one.
I know. I was looking back over I have a friend on the illustrious site of Facebook who lives in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and they had one little dusting of snow. And I said, are you kidding me? We have had snow on the ground nearly every day in December except for a couple of days when we got above 32. We have been cold and icy and snowy in Kentucky this year.
That's
which doesn't normally happen this early.
Yeah. Oh, well. Seems like home to me. So it's not all that weird to me. But
yeah, you northern Indiana people.
Although we'd have 8 or 10 or 12 inches, but yeah, this is bad.
I know.
Soil.
Well, and the thing is, the temperature hasn't gotten warm enough to melt it. And so our little 2 or 3 inches has just stayed and stayed and stayed because it hasn't been warm. So anyway, enough about the weather. We're sounding really old. Like when people get obsessed with weather like that. All right. Let's move on to our other topics for tonight. This is finishing up the great questions I had from my Louisiana conferences. And there was a great lady in Baton Rouge, and she talked to me about this over the lunch break, and she was really cute. You know, my husband Johnny is my business partner and travels with me too, and so she was talking to us about this. And again, I got all these grandmother questions when I was in Louisiana. And I said this last week on the show, we are not at that stage in our lives yet, but I can so see the writing on the wall about being concerned about some of these things. And, you know, if this were happening to me, oh, my goodness, how would I feel? How would I handle it? What would I do? So it's just been really kind of neat to think about that and hear these questions. And this was a grandmother who was a special instructor. And so like a DI person like you, Kate, and she said, you know, when you were talking about the activities that are not recommended for toddlers with social delays, I happened to think about my granddaughter who lives in another state. And she said she knows so much academic language. You know, she can quote little rhymes. She knows all of her letters and numbers. She sings the ABCs. She counts to whatever you want her to count to. She, you knows her colors. She knows her shapes. She said, but she cannot carry on a normal little conversation to save her life. She said, if she is performing, if her parents say, tell her blah, blah, she does great. But when it's just that social, normal, everyday conversation.
As long as blah, blah, blah is something they've practiced. Not tell us what you did at preschool today. That would throw her
right.
Place. Right, yeah.
Well, that would be like a real-life question. And she
right.
said she can't do any of that. And she said that it's so different from how this grandmother remembers her own children to be. And she's always surprised. She said, because, you know, usually you think about children who can do that and really kind of turn it on to perform like that as really being pretty, oh, gosh, just great at language. You would think that their little language skills are just their strength or their forte. And she said, and it is so not true. When she tries to ask her what she wants to eat or just talk about something, and she said she is expressing her basic wants and needs, and she is initiating when she has to, but to really participate in a conversation, she said it's just not there yet. And she is really concerned about it, but again, because she's the grandmother, and I think this is another, she's the mother-in-law, and so it makes it a little difficult to talk to her daughter-in-law about that and to say, gosh, you know, she, you know, why don't you lay off the whole teaching her all these pre-academic things or these academic concepts. So by that I mean the ABCs, the numbers, the colors, and the shapes, and really focus on just talking to her and just having these little routine exchanges so that you're, you know, talking about whatever's going on or, again, like you said, what you did at preschool, just those little conversations that you're able to have with typically developing two-year-old. She said that there's obviously no focus on that because she is terrible at that, and that she doesn't think that her daughter-in-law or her son have paid much attention to that because they're so busy getting her to perform that they've missed that. So I thought that was a great question, and she said, what would you do? And I said, I would swallow really hard and then say, hey, we've got to talk about something here. This is what I've noticed. You know, she's obviously really smart because she's learning all these things, but I'm really kind of concerned about her day-to-day interactions and just how she's able to carry on a little conversation. And she just said, gosh, I don't know. I know I should do it, but I don't know if I can do it. And it was just an interesting dilemma for this grandmother who works with language-delayed children every day. And again, she's not saying that her granddaughter is delayed per se, but she's just worried about real-life language for her. And she thought about her a lot during that portion of the conference. So what advice would you have for her, Kate? Because I didn't do too great of a job of saying, you just got to have a conversation. You've just got to talk about it. You've got to talk to the little girl in front of them and so they can see what you're talking about.
Right.
So they
that
can
would probably be my first suggestion. You know, make sure you're with them and it's a comfortable, relaxed situation and kind of set the stage for her to not fail, but set the stage for her
right.
to, you know, set a situation where you're going to ask her those kinds of little questions or try and engage her in a very normal, everyday conversation that you would typically be able to have with a two-year-old. And that I'd kind of take, and I do that with work a lot. I'll say, I'm trying to get him to respond to this. Is that something he normally does? And normally the parents say, no. And that
yeah.
kind of gives you an opportunity. You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes they say
sure.
yes, and sometimes it's true they do, but they just aren't at that time. But a lot of
right.
times, normally when I'm asking it, it's something I've tried before anyway, and I've kind of had a
right.
little bit of a nagging feeling that this is something we need to be a little bit focused on, and so normally I know they're going to say no. But in that case, I would think that they would say, no, she really doesn't do that, you know, and they might say, we don't really ask her those sorts of things, or we, you know, that's not something we've been aware of. And with families, you know, that I'm working with, that's when I say, well, you know, I think we all need to be real aware of that and really make some effort to continue to focus on that, because really she should be able to be responding appropriately to these simple questions by now. And it may be a
right.
simple case of they just really haven't. You know, I think some of us are
right.
natural talkers, you know, with our kids, and some of us aren't. And if they're not...
Well, these were zany, brainy, professional people. I don't
mm-hmm.
remember exactly what this particular woman said that her children did, but I think it was like a lawyer and maybe a chemist or something, biochemist or some kind of sciencey person. Johnny's saying, yeah, that's what it was. And so, again, they may have been so, like you've said, focused on teaching her all those little things that they think that their children should know and not really done a lot of that day-to-day conversation.
Right. I always wonder, Laura, and you and I really, we've talked about this a couple of weeks ago because we thought we'd get it to it sooner, and wouldn't you know, we ran over a time or two, so we're getting to it now, and I'm just going to throw this out here, and you may be able to negate what I'm, or respond to what I'm saying just by what she told you, but now when I see kids with work who present like this, who are able to do their little routines, go through the ABCs, label colors, tell me about the shapes. You know, we see a lot of those kids. And
right.
They aren't really using language functionally. They aren't really
right.
taking turns in communication. It's really just step up and perform these kind of well-practiced responses to very concrete questions, and they look good at that, but then, you know, when you get them into the everyday respond to what I'm saying, you don't necessarily get the desired response, at least not much, and sometimes never. I always kind of wonder, okay, is this is a kind of a receptive language problem? Do they not really understand because these aren't things that have been practiced?
Right.
Did you get the feeling from her at all whether she had that concern or...
She was not concerned about receptive language. She said that she could, and Johnny, correct me, you're listening. She wasn't concerned about receptive language. She felt like that she did understand things, that she played pretty well. She just said the only thing that really struck her is if she was trying just to have a little conversation with her, and there was no back and forth responding, you know, when she just tried to talk to her about her day or playing or anything like that. All of her language really tended to be, her expressive language, this kind of performance-based thing, you know, great at naming pictures, great at, you know, her little quoting, whatever she had learned, excuse me, but she said she did not have receptive language concerned. But, you know, I always wonder that about these kids, too, because that's why so many children that are on the spectrum aren't identified until they are older, because their moms and dads think, gosh, there could be nothing wrong with her. I mean, one mom on the website, I got this interesting comment this week from a mom who said that she is from a family of people who have been diagnosed as being on the spectrum. Let me see if I can pull it up right here. And she said her dad has Asperger's, and then she has a brother who's 13 or so who's really low functioning, but that's on the spectrum. She said, but her daughter, because she's, say, 27 months, she has all these huge strengths. Like, she knows all of the letters of her alphabet. She knows the accompanying phonetic sounds. She's echolalic when she asks her a question, but she can quote all these scripts and things. She can take a rubber band and make it into any shape that someone is asking her. So she's really visual. She's into all those shapes and things. Yeah.
I've never seen that particular trick. That's interesting.
Yeah. She recognizes octagons and pentagons. And she said one time she was trying to ask her what her hand was when her palm was open. She was going for hand, and the little girl moved it, you know, kind of funny, and said, it's a rectangle. And so her preschool teacher and her pediatrician think that she should be tested for giftedness, you know, ahead and start fancy schmancy preschool. But the mom says, in my heart of hearts, I think she's on the spectrum.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And she said, because, you know, it's just, I recognize this, and I'm really, really concerned about it. And
just
she, you know,
as we are when we see that sort of behavior.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it is, yeah, it's funny how people look at some of those academic strengths. And, again, we're not saying that children who do that aren't really, really smart, but they just have sometimes, if there's not that real-life language piece to kind of back that up, they really look quirky, and they're not able to really function. You know, there's a big gap between, okay, you know all these things. You know, you can, again, take a rubber band and be able to shape it into all those shapes. I don't know if I could do that, you know.
27 months. That's
27 months.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty amazing. Again, but she can't answer a question. She said she can't answer, what's your name? She says name. You know, what do you want to do? She says, want to do. You know, she's completely echolalic on questions. She's not processing language. And so, you know, the mom said, should I be concerned about her? And I said, yeah, based on what you've written in. And,
follow your instinct,
you know,
mom,
your family history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so
and
for
I
kids
would be
like this.
Even without the family history on a kid like that. And it's very hard because I totally understand. And on one level, it is really smart. It's those gaps, though. Typically when kids know their shapes and their colors and their numbers and their ABCs, and sometimes two-year-olds do know those things, but they also can talk to you. They also understand and respond, you know, most of the time pretty appropriately.
Right.
And when they don't, it is a red flag for kids on the spectrum. It just is, you know. It's unfortunate that her pediatrician isn't catching that.
Has missed that, yeah. Well, I hope she can have some honest discussions, and I recommended that she get a speech eval from a speech pathologist who is experienced in working with children on the spectrum and who can point out her and recognize her weaknesses as well as her strengths. And I think that she might take her to some speech pathologist who would get on the, no, this is great, bandwagon.
She's smart.
Without
she's
really...
doing great. Not to say she's not smart, but obviously there are some big holes there when she's...
Yeah.
You know, parroting back everything that's said to her and doesn't seem to understand what in the world. And those are everyday, normal, typically developing kids get, do you want a cookie?
Right.
Before they get, it's an octagon. You know, that's just...
Right, exactly.
I'm fine
exactly.
with it's an octagon if they know what do you want a cookie means. You know, if they
or
know...
Or she
want,
said that she'll...
Play.
The mom will say, are you tired? And she just says, tired. You know, and again, how the mom has written it, she's not saying that she's, you know, saying tired, like shaking her head yes in response, like, oh, mom, I am worn out, tired. You know, she's just repeating what mama said, so she's obviously not processing
that
question.
Right. And a lot of that, looking at that, is kind of reading the child's cues and the quality of how they respond and the nature of how they respond. It's obvious, really, at least for anybody with much experience working with young kids,
Sometimes kids do respond that way. Johnny, are you tired? Tired. And they look at you like, yeah, I'm beat. Or, you know, do you want a cookie? Cookie. And his eyes are twinkling and he's smiling. He knows what you said. But do you want a cookie? Cookie. Or do you want a cookie? Do you want a cookie? And they don't go to the kitchen. They don't reach for the cookies. They don't. There's nothing. It's just they're giving you back the words. But it's pretty obvious, I think, to most people. Didn't probably understand that.
Right, or the kids who can't make a choice. You know, you want juice or milk. Juice or milk! Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of want something to drink, but I'm not really quite sure what you said, maybe beyond that, or this sounded like it was going to be something good for me, so I'm just going to repeat it so that I get it, because you usually like it when I repeat what you say. And we get those kids a lot in therapy that just, and those are the kids with the receptive language issues that really know how much we initially get excited with that imitation. So, boy, don't they latch onto that and hold on to that for a long time. And you can tell there are still things that they really don't understand, mm-hmm. even though they might seem excited, even though they might seem like. And that's kind of an in-between response from what you're talking about. You're talking about the kids that are just imitating, just blindly imitating. It wouldn't matter what you said. You know, should we read the Declaration of Independence? Independence! You know, right. Versus the kids who are kind of moving that way, who understand, okay, this is, she's asking me, do I want one of two fun things, and I'm not quite sure which is which, so let me just kind of repeat what she said, because usually when she gives me a choice, there's going to be something fun at the end. And that's the kind of kid that we see in therapy that's kind of in between a lot of times. They get that you're asking them something. They're still just not quite sure which one is which and don't quite understand how to make that choice. But that is a step in the right direction versus the kid who would just kind of blindly repeat what you've said with no awareness that it's a choice or it's something they're supposed to respond to with a novel response or a new idea. Or in a way other than kind of repeating. So it is a red flag, and it does happen a lot with children who are on the spectrum. Now, some children do this that aren't on the spectrum that just are having pretty significant receptive language delays if they're well over two, or later children who even seem to have fairly good comprehension for really simple, familiar things, but then that gap kind of starts to really be prevalent when their systems are challenged, like they're in a preschool classroom and it's really noisy, or, when our little kids with delays are sick, they kind of fall apart a little bit, and you might see them echo or respond, kind of get those off-target responses when they're sick or when they've just had an off day. Again, I think about their little systems being challenged and they, you know, they kind of fall apart language-wise then too. So it doesn't necessarily always mean that a child, you know, definitely has autism. Yeah, there could be these other
delays. I mean, for that, you're looking for some other fairly significant things to accompany it. But I do go to receptive language issues pretty immediately, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
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 And maybe that includes being on the spectrum and maybe it doesn't, and there certainly is a difference,
right.
But the receptive language thing is kind of my first thought. I'm not sure she's really understanding. Kids don't typically label shapes like that or form them out of rubber bands and not understand people
and not understand other things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not to say that those academic strengths aren't something that mom can use to really work on other things. And certainly when children are having difficulty listening to directions or processing what I'm saying, and I'm thinking, okay, I've got to come up with some kind of little therapy game that will hook them, that they will want to play with me and pay attention and stay with me instead of doing their own thing, I might use some of their little strengths in that way. But again, like you've said, it's just not typical development, and when there are those splinter skills there and those gaps, it is a red flag, and so I think mom was right to be worried about that. Now, going back to our original question, I think the grandmother's first response really should be, again, talking to her daughter-in-law and son about her concerns and, again, demonstrating some of that so that they can see what's happening. And maybe it's just kind of steering them in the right direction. And if this were happening to me, I would say what I say to lots of my parents and, you know, in of children that I work with, and say, we're not going to work on ABCs and numbers and colors and shapes. We're not even going to focus on those things. We're going to focus on real-life things that make a difference, that real-life vocabulary, and save all that school stuff for after she turns three. And she's going to learn that stuff anyway. Let's work on things right now that really, really matter in her everyday life. And for this little girl who, again, this grandmother didn't really have concerns in any other way except that just her expressive language, kind of that back-and-forth conversational turn-taking, you know, she could just give parents some tips to work on that. And you start with just by talking about what the little girl is doing and getting her to answer questions about that. And do that every day and work that into your routines. And she has to be able to do that before she can answer a question like, what did you do at preschool today? You know, it's got to even be kind of semi-structured first. And if she can't do it in that situation, she's certainly not going to be able to do it when it's more abstract, like, you know, again, what she did when mom and dad weren't there to really give her really know what to ask about. She seems like she's a child that needs specifics before she could answer an open-ended question. So that would be my recommendation to that grandmother. And maybe she'll get a chance to do that over the holidays, over Christmas if she sees them. I hope that she will be able to address that. And I know how concerned she must be, and at the same time a little less than eager to step on any toes with her son and with her daughter-in-law.
It's hard for us in working with families and parents, and can be very, whether it's your daughter or your daughter-in-law, it just kind of depends on the dynamics. That can be touchy. It would be good if she did actually do it with both parents there, so it's not a situation where she's telling the son and then the son relays the information and it messages you know,
wires are crossed, and your mother said.
It would be good if it was just when they were hanging out, and she could kind of set the stage for it and ask them together, and you know, just kind of gently go there. And it may be that, hopefully, just with a little attention, a little focus on that, the child's going to do just fine with that. It may be that she hasn't had much exposure, but I would have my concerns about the receptive language piece there.
Right.
Even though she says it's not an issue, I would still want to make sure myself, if I were working with this child, I thought, I'd want to see it, but it may be.
You would be giving her lots of little directions to follow in the context of play, so you could check that out yourself, huh?
Mm-hmm. Just to see if she got it. And she may very well, but normally kids who can do all those other things do not struggle at all with those kinds of everyday exchanges.
Right, and so it is a red flag. And so she did have a reason to kind of be concerned about it. And, again, this is an out-of-state grandmother, so I don't think she's seen her very much or doesn't get to see her, you know, like every other day or anything. So, you know, that's an extra dynamic.
Yeah, herself.
Yeah.
She'd be saying, oh, she can come to my house and play today.
There you go.
Right,
but that's
there.
An extra dynamic, too, because sometimes children don't become comfortable with grandmothers or people that they see every few months right away. So that certainly is something that probably doesn't account for the whole thing, but at least for the first hour or two. And I know that really hurts grandmothers' feelings to think about that and hear that. And but, you know, that's kind of temperament-wise with toddlers, but that wouldn't be the only reason that this grandmother appears to be concerned. And, again, I think that just her awareness and will probably start that whole ball rolling just with her thinking about it more and, you know, thinking, okay, that bothered me last time I saw her, but, you know, it really kind of bothers me to hear somebody else talk about it in that way. So hopefully she'll be able to address that. Maybe she already has. Who knows?
Well, and you know, Laura, in her defense and all the parents' defenses, look, here she has – oh, that was a different story. But my point was, so often when you look at language milestones, it really – what's emphasized is how many words does the child have? How is
she
using two-word phrases? They don't really necessarily – you know, you could probably find the information, but it's not the information that's shared most often. It's not the information that's emphasized. They talk about total number of words. Are they using phrases? They don't. And I've certainly seen kids that, as you said, for the email question you received, make sure you get somebody who's experienced in working with kids on the spectrum, because that child was on one level very verbal. You know, she could say about her favorite Dora show or whatever it was. It was probably very scripted. But, wow, if you really weren't very versed in working with kids like that, I could see why the pediatrician would think, well, there's not a problem. Listen to her talk. You know, she can sing the whole ABC song. You know, she's only 27 months. That's amazing. And on one level it is. But so it's easy for parents to really miss that. And therapists sometimes as well, because they're kind of hyper-focused on, well, she can tell you her name, she can tell you Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, she can, and wow, that's a lot of talking. But they don't really get what's the quality or nature of the talking. So,
exactly. And two, sometimes with those kids, even the kids that are a little bit social, say they're not completely isolated, they do make some eye contact, they do get that you're talking to them, there is a hint of joint attention there. I can totally see where a pediatrician would miss that at 27 months, especially if you're just used to seeing herds of children and meeting medical needs and not really spending time in play or a conversation beyond, you know, making sure that those milestones are there. So it would be easy to miss. And I do think that sometimes those children that are on the spectrum might even slip through the cracks in early intervention systems, especially now, like our state, you know, is using that whole phone questionnaire to decide if a child even gets evaluated. And so for a child like that, she won't even make it past the phone evaluation because she already knows all those things. That's like my little friend that I saw several years ago that I walked into the home and she met me singing Happy Birthday. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I've never heard more perfect articulation in a kid. And her mom said that, you know, yesterday she watched, you know, Barney with the Happy Birthday thing. But until you really start, again, folding back those layers and really looking at more than just the black and white objectives, you could really, really miss a pretty significant language delay with kids like that. And that little girl is now, she's so cute, she's quite a singer now, and I keep up with her mom on Facebook, and she now posts, like, arias that she's singing, and she'll sing, like, take a song and sing it in four or five different languages.
Oh.
And again, it looks, it really, she's echolalic, and so she can do all that. And it, again, is a nice skill. And her mom recognizes that as a strength, but her mom also understands the importance of the real-life language and the everyday stuff, and you know, which is why she's been in speech since she was 2.5, and when her mom and dad really realized, and she still continues to be in speech, but they, you know, she's darling, too, when she sings those songs, and if I were her parents, I would show that off, too, so it really kind of cute to see the flip side of that as well, but it is easy to miss because I'm sure some people would hear her do that and think there's no way that little girl can be autistic.
Right.
You know, there's no way that she's on the spectrum. She's smart. And being autistic and having academic strengths is not mutually exclusive. You know, you're sometimes people don't understand that so many of those children have really specific strengths. Maybe really visual with, you know, reading it too. Or, again, like this little girl, having an eye for shapes and knowing how to do that and put that together. And, again, those are strengths and those are things that her parents should be proud about and feel that she's smart. But when there are those gaps there, that's when we should really get concerned. And as professionals, we should do a better job of talking to parents about those gaps and recognizing those gaps and realizing that those kinds of kids are that benefit the most through treatment because they already have some skills to kind of build on and you already know the potential is there versus, say, a nonverbal kid who had no interest in people whatsoever. So those are the kids that really, really, really need to be in treatment and that I just have a ball treating, and I'm sure you do too, Kate, because they're fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have something to work on and work with, so there you go. Okay, let's move on. Excuse me. All right, this is kind of a related question almost because this comes from a person who attended my Louisiana conference, and she says, I recently attended your conference, Taking Theory to the Floor in Baton Rouge, and I was completely inspired to start using more social games with my clients. However, this is not going as smoothly as I thought. Some kids are very resistant to this type of interaction, and one even scratched me to indicate that he was not interested. I'm wondering if this type of response is common at first and whether or not I should continue with these games when a child clearly does not want to interact this way. And I should have done a better job of stating why this is kind of this related to the same thing. Lots of the kids that we've just kind of talked about that fit that profile of having those real visual strengths or being able to kind of quote long scripts and that are echolalic. And sometimes those children really don't have those nice interactive skills and they're not very social. So while, again, they may be able to perform, they're not able to do much one-on-one interaction. They might seem to be on their own little worlds when they play. They might totally tune out language and just might look pretty isolated. And so when we start to treat these children, we have to really look at them and address their social skills first, because until you can make that connection on a personal level and really get children engaged, and by that I mean that they're right there with you, that they're looking at you, they're looking at the toy, they're looking at their moms, you know, it's back and forth. It's not just once they play with the toy, every other person in the room disappears. It's that nice shared focus that you have when you have to get that first, and children have to be able to do that first, because until kids can really, really engage on that level, then they don't learn how to process language adequately. And the theory is they don't learn how to use that language then because they're missing those foundational pieces. So when we start with working with toddlers, we say, get them engaged, get them to want to play with you. Do those fun little games. And if we take typical development as our model for this, we would teach games that moms and dads normally play with their babies, peekaboo, patty cake, any other little finger plays or songs that they would do, any of those little typical little back-and-forth games. So that's what a lot of my conference is talking to speech pathologists about how to introduce those games in play, how to set up those games in little small steps so that their clients and, more importantly, the parents of those 2-year-olds or 1-year-olds or 3-year-olds, whatever age kid they're working with, can understand that this is a step toward understanding and using language appropriately. So our friend here is saying that it's not going so well in her first attempts to use that. And it was so interesting, Kate, because when I first sent this to you, because she said resistant, and my initial response to her was, I don't know that I would call any kid resistant that I've done it with, but you had a different take on that and said, yeah, I would classify some kids that I've started that with as resistant.
I would, yeah. And part of that may be, Laura, because I think you are by nature more touchy-feely, and you this social stuff for you is so second nature that
right.
your approach is better than mine, as much as I hate to say that. It's something that I've had to work on, and I still sometimes have to remind myself of, you know, I always use your little buzz term on that one, ratchet it up,
You know, I think that because although my approach to therapy is pretty high energy, sometimes I think my little bit of discomfort with the, not that I'm uncomfortable holding kids, but, and I think you go on to kind of talk about this a little bit in your written response, but, you know, some kids that we work with are very sensitive to being touched. And,
right.
You know, to go to
right.
grab one of those kids and they act like you're going to rip their arm off, and that kind of
right.
makes me feel like, oh, you know, I don't want to
screw it up,
upset.
And this mom
yeah.
is watching. Yeah.
Be happy. And so, yeah, I would definitely say that not the majority of the kids that I work with. More often than not, I would say the initial response, particularly with those kids who are socially kind of non-responsive or, you know, give you little response, they're flat. You know, I'm
right.
saying, ride a little horsey, and they're on my lap bouncing, and they're looking at me like, yeah, when's this over? You know, it's not.
Right, and I agree with that, and that's why
yeah.
I felt, like, resistant. I thought, gosh, I don't know that too many kids that I would characterize as resistant. Had she gone with another word, like, it was non-responsive, or they did nothing, they didn't like it.
Right.
You know,
well,
that would have been.
I have one right now who is, I'd say, still resistant. And she was a micro preemie. She has lots of, not huge sensory things, but one of her sensory things she certainly has is she does not like to be touched. She doesn't. She's very,
right.
she'll let mom and dad hold her some. Even that is, you know, if you touch her hands,
right.
man, she pulls them back immediately. If you. And
right.
I know you talk about this in the conference, and I don't always rush right in, grab and put them on my lap, and do right a little horsey, or
mm-mm.
go right.
Neither
in.
Do I
do a lot of touching them in play, you know, just
right.
touching their little faces and touching their little hands and rubbing their little legs, and I want them to kind of
right.
desensitize to being touched by me. And so if you go for the gusto out of the gate, and by that I mean you do launch right into whatever little, particularly those that you're holding them, those really can
right.
set them off. You know, that's really, they'll do a dive the other direction if they are really resistant to just being touched in general. So I always...
And so for those kinds of kids, you don't do that. You save that for after you've kind of established that relationship. And for
once
some
they
kids,
know
that's
you
a few weeks.
They trust you, yeah.
Yeah, and so for some kids, it might be a long time. It might be several mm. months.
Right.
And so I think that just becomes more comfortable with kind of reading a kid's sensory systems and having lots of ideas to think, okay, he doesn't like for me to touch him, but how else can I kind of make this social or make it cute so that he can want to be with me and knows that I'm teasing him and knows that this is supposed to be fun without me kind of ticking him off and losing him altogether. And I think that just comes with practice. It comes with failing and thinking, oh, man, I really blew it on that kid. I should have taken it slower. I should have, instead of, you know, grabbing him and making him sit on my lap, to play ride a little horsey, I could have just done something simpler like I boom, or and that's a little game where, you know, like if you have a kid on one side of the bed and you're on the other side. I'm thinking particularly of one of my little friends with autism named Zachary, who's probably 7 or 8 now, but he did not like to be touched at all. And my little social games with him were really me hiding under the covers of his bed, or him hiding and me doing ah boom, where I raise my hands, go ah boom, and then slamming them down on the bed. And he just thought that was hysterical. And any other little interactive thing where, you know, he did like for me to pick him up and throw him down, but not pick him up and hug him. You know, and so you just have to kind of read a kid and figure out where a kid is and then have your thinking cap on. You know, you can't just have 3 or 4 little tricks and think it's going to work with every kid. You've got to have, you know, lots of tricks. You've got to have a big little mental filing cabinet with, okay, for this kind of kid, I need to try this game, this game, this game, this game, and this game. And then if that doesn't work, I'm going to try this. And so it does really come with a whole kind of think on your feet and think, okay, you didn't like that. How can I change it so that it won't be as likely to cause him to be resistant. Because if you're losing a kid, there's really, that just tells you he's not ready yet, and you've got to not stop doing it. You've just got to address his social stuff in a different way. If he doesn't like to be touched, then you're just going to have to come up with some things where you're not touching him, or whether you're doing it in a way that's less aversive. Again, I think I've said that word 10 times, but, you know, where he's less likely to have that really strong reaction. And like you were talking about helping kind of desensitize, where you're, you know, reaching out and kind of touching his leg or patting him or doing something all the whole session, so that it becomes normal for you to touch him, not just, oh my gosh, what is this lady doing to me, when you put him on your lap. And especially if she's not treated kids in this way before, it would almost be harder with that kind of kid, because I just kind of do this social stuff from the second I stick my toe in their door.
Right.
So it's not as weird as for when you've been doing something for weeks or months, and then all of a sudden you kind of go in and change your game plan. Then it's like a whole new person. You know,
right.
He doesn't know what to expect.
If her approach has been to not use those strategies up until she saw your conference, I could see where kids would be like, who is this, and what happened to the lady?
Wow.
Who? Yeah. Yeah.
And if she's never done it before, she's probably, it's probably not like second nature yet. Like anything
right.
you learn that's new, you fumble around and you're not quite good at it yet. You're not that confident yet. You're still kind of struggling yourself. But you got to learn sometime and somewhere. So just, I would tell her, just plunge ahead, knowing that every session is not going to go great. And even with kids, you know, that I do this with kids all the time and have done it for a long time this way, but there's still kids that you're just going to have to try and try and try. You know, you don't give up. You don't just do a game one time and think, well, forget it, he doesn't like it. You know, you change it a little bit. Or, I mean, for the flat kids, you just keep doing it because you think, he doesn't like it yet, but he's not really responding yet. So you just, with those kids, I would just repeat the same thing. But for kids who were scratching me or biting me or trying to smack me and then get away, I would think, okay, I've got to get them with a different kind of game. Because on some level, I have really made them too mad for them to think this is fun. You know, it's either it's most likely a sensory processing thing. She's either touched them or it's just been too in their face or too much of a change from how she played in the past. So she's just going to have to go at it gradually. And I think that she bought the book, Teach Me to Play with You. And so she needs to go through there and think, okay, for these kids who don't like being touched, what kinds of games? And they're at the top of every page of every little game or every little routine, there's a section that says, great for a child who. And so she should just flip through there and say, you know, find a kid who doesn't like being touched, a kid who has tactile sensitivities, a kid who likes to run, you know, and play those games first, and then save the ones that are too in his face for later when he becomes more comfortable with that kind of social routine.
Right. Yeah, and I think, Laura, she would benefit also from seeing it, and she could see clips on the website or on YouTube, or she could bite the bullet and get the DVD, and I'd say start with Teach Me to Talk, because honestly, I like I said, it is not second nature to me. It's much better now, but I would not have, had I not known you and benefited from watching you and then doing the DVDs and all that, I remember years and years and years ago, we crossed paths in a daycare, and I knew you, but I didn't know you that well. And we both saw the child together for an hour, and at the end of the hour, I thought, I'm going to have to change my approach a little bit, because you were much.
See, I don't even remember that, but oh well.
I remember it. It was in Indiana, and I went away thinking, one, I need to use more energy. I need to be higher energy, more animated in general. And two, you were more hands-on than I was. And anymore, I think it is, I wouldn't necessarily say, well, it's fairly second nature to me, but I've been doing it for 10 years. You know, I didn't
just
go to a conference and decide tomorrow I'm going to do it. So you certainly get better. It's something I've had to, you know, really kind of think about a lot. I'll say this, for those kids who, I mean, I know now when I see a kid the first time how sensitive they are to touch, because I'm going to help them sign more, and I'm going to help them sign eat,
right,
help them sign go. And when you touch I call them touchy kids, which is certainly not a professional term, but I just mean they're touchy. And it probably doesn't even make sense to anybody, but it does to me. What I mean is they're very
It does to me, yes.
You know,
they're
I call
sensitive.
Them,
they don't like you all over.
Kind of touchy. You go to grab their hands, and even if you're holding up a cookie they really want, and you know they want it, and you say, tell me more, and they're not doing anything, I'm going to always grab their hands and help them sign it. And when touch isn't an issue for them, normally kids don't really respond to it. They may not form their hands and sign more, but they're not going to pull back. They're not going to squirm away. They're not going to maybe, you know, make a funny noise because you've touched them. But those kids who bristle and pull back, the first thing out of my mouth,
yes,
the first thing in my head is he's a little sensitive to that. He's a little, quote-unquote, touchy. And so I know from 5 minutes into my first session, I'm going to have to tread lightly. It doesn't mean I'm not going to go there. I certainly am, because I think it's that's one of those barriers that you have to work through. But I'm going to be a little bit more sensitive to touching that child. I'm going to make sure that when I do touch the child, there's a payoff for the kid, and he's engaged and distracted by whatever it is we're doing, so that it's not just I'm going to reach out and grab his hand or touch his arm, or, you know, I'm going to do it in the context
of play. It makes sense.
And if you hook them that way, it does kind of lower their resistance to that touching. A lot of those kids I tickle pretty early. I find that a lot of kids that are real sensitive to touch sometimes, but not always, and none of our tidbits, our morsels of thought are 100%, unfortunately. Wouldn't that be great if they all worked 100%?
Oh, it would be, yeah.
But I have found that a lot of kids who are sensitive to touch do respond well to tickling, and I get their bellies more often than anything else, or under their arms, but a lot of times their bellies. And I think that has to do with, I'm no OT, but in my little simple reasoning, there's something about a lot of kids who are sensitive to touch are sensitive to light touch. You know, it's like you just barely, and it's very counterintuitive to me, because I think, well, if you're sensitive to touch, light touch would be less disturbing than deep touch. And in fact, more often than not, that's not the case. It's that light touch, just a little brush on their arms, just gently holding their hands, sends them off. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but I just know that's the way it is. And so the heavy, deep tickling, they normally, typically respond to pretty well, whereas a light touch on their hands to get them to sign more, to sign eat, that can be very aversive to them. So I may go.
Or patting their backs pretty hard, you know, not just a little rub, but a pretty hard pat. And, you know, our OT friends really talk about when we're desensitizing kids to kind of start with their feet or their legs and work your way up. And so don't you just find yourself when you're sitting there playing with the kid, you know, just when you're going to say good job or something was funny, you reach out and jiggle their legs and do it that way rather than, you know, just a little touch on their hands or whatever.
Well,
and I do think lots
of like to have their feet touched too. I don't know what that is exactly, but I just know. And sometimes it's those kids who do have those sensitive hands. They love to have their feet messed with. I've even, in desperation, taken kids' feet and signed more with their feet because they're so darn sensitive with their hands.
Well, and they think it's hysterical
when
you do
that.
So I'll play clap your feet.
Yeah,
and I play clap your feet, kick your feet a lot, and then kind of work your way up to being able to hold their hands. And there's a nice section about that in Teach Me to Play with You as well, if any person has that book and hasn't had a chance to read that section yet. And it is based on that theory that OTs teach us, that you have to kind of help normalize or desensitize how they process being touched. And it is, again, like you've said, doesn't make a lot of sense when you're thinking about it in just kind of a casual oh, that's so weird kind of way. But when you really start thinking about, okay, their systems, I've got to kind of get them ready. I've got to get their little bodies ready for this. It does make sense when you start with the deeper touch and start kind of farther away from what might be more sensitive, which is usually those little hands. Mouths are another sensitive place, which is why I don't understand lots of speech pathologists who would go straight for touching a kid, you know, moving his mouth, trying to do prompt or, you know, feeding therapy where they're doing lots of oral motor stuff and sticking their fingers or a toothpick.
Don't forget sticking that toothpick in there. That's a big one.
Inside a sensitive toddler's mouth, I mean, that is just the biggest way turn them off.
Have your finger have a bite. Let me just say that.
I'll take a bite, all right. It'll be from your finger or your face or whatever I can get. You know, it's not going to be of that food. Yeah, so it makes more sense to me that you're going to have to get their little bodies ready for that. Lots of those kids with touch sensitivities will do much better after they've done movement kinds of games. And so if you get them kind of doing ring around the rosy and you're jumping up and down, you know, don't even hold their hands to do it the first few times they're doing it. Some of those kids will let you kind of hold them under their arms and kind of drag them. They think that's kind of fun rather than holding their hands, or other kinds of things where they jump off the couch 50 times to kind of get their little bodies warmed up and revved up, and then they're able for you to hold their hands to do ring around the rosy in a more traditional way. And if you're a speech pathologist who this is like the first time you've really thought about this or heard this, I'm going to beg you to get yourself a good sensory book and read it. What's that Lucy J. Miller book, Kate?
Is that the one?
No, that's a different one, but that's a good one too, Raising a Sensory Smart Child. But the Lucy J. Miller book explains it so well. Let me look in my books real quick. Out of Sync Child is good too. Did I already say that out loud?
No.
Oh, I can never remember what her book is called, and I can't reach it. But get yourself a good sensory book or to a good sensory conference, or make a friend with an OT who will talk you through some of this over the phone or have lunch with you or let you kind of tag along with her in sessions to talk about some of this sensory stuff, because it really does make a big difference. And I don't see how you could really be an effective early interventionist without having a pretty basic understanding of treating sensory processing differences. Do you?
No. And like I said, I don't always understand the theory, or I just know some kids present like this, this seems to work. Some kids present like this, this seems to work. You know,
But you know that because you've read things and because you've gone to conferences and
right.
Because you've listened when you've sat in all those meetings. You know, it is based on pulling an idea out of the air.
It's pretty rudimentary. I don't really always get where an OT might be able to talk about it for 20 minutes. I just say, well, here's what I learned. Here's what I'm going to do differently, or here's what I'm going to try next time around. You know, I'm just saying, for me, I want to know, I'm about the theory to the floor part, so I may not understand it in an intellectual way.
Well,
I just know what works.
And I've done a lot of the intellectual side of that because I have a sensory kid who is now 21, but to help me parent him really effectively through those preschool years when sensory stuff was first kind of becoming a big deal, and especially through elementary school when he had lots of difficulty learning to read and write and had lots of quirky little things, like he couldn't wash the lunch tables at school because he would throw up if he saw other food, and after the fourth or fifth day of picking him up in a row and me saying to the teacher, look, no more table washing. This is why. Let me give you an article about this. And, you know, doing research for my own real life, I really do think I have a pretty good understanding, you know, not like an OT with a master's degree would have, but from a mom and from a perspective of a person who treats these kinds of things all the time. But I really think understanding sensory processing differences and having, again, more than one or two tricks in your bag about what to do with these kinds of kids will really help. The Lucy J. Miller book is called Sensational Kids.
And
the subtitle is Hope and Help for Children with Sensory Processing Disorder. It's great. The other one that you talked about, Raising a Sensory Smart Kid, is good, too. I had that one as well. And then the one that we all read, you know, 10, 15 years ago was The Out of Sync Child, or at least 10 years ago. Like, probably longer than that for me, because I think I remember reading that when Jonathan was in kindergarten or so.
Now that was
but those are
go-to sensory book. It's changed a little bit. Still good, but there are a couple others that are good.
And we did a whole series last fall, or maybe it was two falls ago, I don't even remember, about sensory processing differences. And you can always listen to those shows in the archives if you go way back. I think it wasn't this past October. It wasn't October 2010. I think it was October 2009 when we did those shows. So if you need some other information about that, you can. What?
I said back when we were having guests on a fairly regular basis, we had a good OT speak about sensory issues.
Yeah,
Let's
go back and listen to some of those shows, too, to kind of help you understand that a little bit more if you're a parent of a kid having those issues or are a therapist that needs some additional training or reminders in that area. But my point is, I don't really see how you can be an effective early interventionist or work with kids birth to three with the caseloads that we see now without having a fairly good understanding of sensory processing differences, because it really does affect lots of things that people attribute just to behavior. Really do start with kind of that sensory processing difference. And if you'll treat it like that and do the things that are effective, the behavior part goes away. And so I'd much rather treat something like that and kind of modify something that I'm doing or introduce a new activity or change the environment or whatever, rather than treat behavior, because that's no fun. Power struggles with toddlers, no fun at all. But if you look at that behavior stuff, if you look at that behavior stuff as kind of maybe starting from that sensory processing difference, you'll be a lot more successful, in my opinion.
I always say with families that I work with that I think we all people have some sensory issues, and certainly all young children have sensory issues. And for sure, lots of the kids that we work with, because these are kids who have been identified as having delays, lots of the kids we work with have sensory issues. And probably the gal who went to your conference and got scratched as a result, she did fail to factor those in, and she got a painful reminder of tread lightly. We're not saying don't go there. It's just you need to kind of take a few steps back and do a little thinking ahead of time, and then proceed with a little bit more caution and maybe set the stage, particularly for those kids who are really, really sensitive or have lots of sensory integration issues, rethink it. Sometimes with those kids, I don't know if I said this is one of those nights. Did we say this or did I just think it?
I know.
I would say with those kids, a lot of times in the beginning, I kind of hook them with some toy, some activity that they like, and then I work that desensitization piece into it, whether we're playing peekaboo, whether I'm tickling them. A lot of times I do stuff where if a toy has a hole in it, I might stick my hand through it in a funny, goofy, animated, exaggerated sort of way and grab them. You know, so I'm kind of working the element of surprise in there, but I'm also kind of working it. I want him to be able to tolerate me touching him. I want him to be...
Right.
You know, responses in a positive way, and if you just go forward and you don't factor in what do I anticipate his reaction to be, you may get a negative response like she got. And, you know, I'm sorry that happened, but she's going to learn from it and she's going to get better at it as a result. So
she really is, and you do just have to keep kind of plugging away at it. And anything you try that's new, you're terrible at. I mean, almost anything I try that's new, you're not going to be as good at it the first time you do it as the 50th time and the 150th time and the 350th time. So you just have to find your way and make it work for you. And again, if it's been a big personality change for you to be this way, that's probably what's going on more than anything. The kid just doesn't know what to expect. So then you're just going to have to make it your normal. And that takes time. You know, there's no other way to say that. You're just going to have to do it and make it so second nature that he kind of expects you to be that way.
It is interesting that kids sometimes can be really good reads on. Is
but
she
I think they are, don't you?
Yeah, it's almost like they, even kids who aren't necessarily that perceptive on some level, it does seem like they, and that's why at the end of the day it's probably a little easier because you're so comfortable with it and it is so second nature to you. For me, I think I've gotten better and better and better, but it's still not as instinctive for me as it is for you. So, and I have to sometimes remind myself of that and make the necessary changes to so that it, at least it appears to be more instinctive for me. You know,
Kate,
really.
I think it is instinctive with you, and I think you're selling yourself short. I've seen you with kids, you know, in the last 6 months.
The playfulness is, Laura, but the touching and holding isn't.
Yeah, and
that
I hold kids. I mean, I'll hold kids in the store. I mean, I just hold kids. And so I do think it, and I remember having a conversation with you a long time ago about that, and you saying you hardly ever held kids. And I was like, what are you talking about? I hold kids all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think that just is, and not that that's necessarily, you know, good or bad. It just is. That's just something I do versus something that you don't do as often. So
yeah,
I think that might be it.
More, but part of that is I've had to consciously be aware of hold them if you can, hold them. Squeeze them, squish them,
yeah.
You know, tickle
yeah.
them, rub them, pound on their back.
Well, and
but it's something I have, it's not instinctive. I have to remind myself to put it into my routine. So
well,
that's
what I
mean.
It really does help make that emotional connection. And
as
a speech therapist grad student would say, establish rapport.
Yes.
You know, it does do that.
Yes,
with
it does.
A baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really does. And so, but then you have the kids. Then I have the kids that's all they want me to do.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just snuggle them and kiss them and hug them. And then I think, okay, we got to back off this just a teeny bit so we can get something else done.
And so
but
really we're, even people who have been doing it for many, 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 many years, sometimes we're thinking on our feet or thinking as we go in the door
yeah.
or as we're walking out the door.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm gonna change that a little bit. And that's fine.
I'm changing that, yeah.
That's the sign
yeah,
of what you've been doing and, you know, trying to get better. Even if you've done it a long time, you can always improve it a little bit.
Absolutely, and that's what makes this job so fun, that we get to keep doing it, and that's what makes the difference between somebody who just goes in and plays with kids
mm-hmm.
versus a real therapist, you know, a professional, somebody who's really skilled. So just keep at it. It'll get easier. If you're I hope that she's listened to the show and's gotten some new ideas and got my comment back. And I did mean to mention this at the beginning of the show, and I forgot. And then we've got to go because I think we're like 10 minutes over now. But
oh my!
All of the comments in the last 10 days have disappeared from the website. I don't know why. I've emailed one of our web people that helps us out. I can't figure out why those comments have disappeared, and hers was one of them. That, like, just for 10 days of comments, the initial comments in that I approved to be on the website, and then my responses are all gone. So I'm going to try to dig out her email if I can and then email her this response. I hope she gets it, and I hope she'll let us know a few weeks or months down the road how it's, you know, kind of evolved for her and her practice, because so many of these things really do take practice and do take time. And I bet that the children she gets as new referrals, it'll be easier to kind of start a lot of this stuff with
right.
than it is children that she's
know.
Seen for months and months.
Not that you
yeah.
can't backtrack and establish that, but for kids who already know her, it is going to be just a little bit harder because it's very foreign to them.
Like a personality change, so they're having to get used to a whole new person. All right, we are not going to have a show next week because it'll be the day after Christmas, so Merry Christmas to all of our listeners, and we will be back the first Sunday in January, which I think is like January 2nd. So,
and we hope to have great shopping reports that night because we're doing some New Year's shopping. We hope to be able to share a lot of cute things that we bought on our shopping strategy.
I don't know if we'll have that as a topic on the show or not.
Oh,
we shall discuss that later. Okay, that's all for tonight. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Thank you.
Bye.